Welcome to Natural Recovery from Suffering. This is Scott Killaby. Well, I haven't done a podcast on death yet, and yet death has surrounded me, really, for my adult life. It surrounds me right now, actually, in a lot of different ways. I'm just real quick. Well, you can't go quickly over trauma or losing people. You know, I'll tell you, nobody wants to lose anybody, and nobody really wants to die alone if they don't have to, no matter how awake they are or how clear. Probably. There may be some people that want to die alone, though. At one time I did. I wanted to kill myself, and I didn't want to do it around anybody else. I didn't even want anybody to know that I was doing it. So I can't say that nobody wants to die alone. There are definitely times in our life when we may want that. But, you know, I also wasn't doing well. When you have that level of pain, you can't really make any decisions except for, I need to survive. And if I can't survive by living, I'll survive by dying, in a way. What I notice about suicidal ideation, once I finally genuinely had it, is that it's the brain produces an option when it doesn't seem like there are any. And it's not actually an incredibly horrible thing when that option is produced, because you don't have any other options. It's almost like, it can be even like a bright side, if your world is dark enough, you know. It was for me. The thought of it was slightly bright. But you have to be in a pretty bad place to have that thought and for that thought to feel bright. Like that's the bright side. But had I been in a better mental state and not in such physical pain, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have wanted to die alone. Certainly wouldn't want to die in agony alone. Medical care is helpful at a very basic level. But I don't think I'd want to die alone either without the people that I love closest to me. Right now, my partner is going through the potential loss of somebody. His grandmother, right as we speak, or as I speak, is close to death. And he was very close to her growing up. He had trauma with his parents. I won't go into all of that, but his grandparents were really, really helpful in raising him, loved him a lot. This is really hard for him, as you can imagine, or it would be for you. If you were close to a grandparent or a parent, and I mean really close, and then you're living, for example, his living parents, he doesn't have a great relationship with them. So this is like, yeah, somebody really important that may be passing very soon, most likely is, within the next couple of days, actually. And, you know, my partner, as I've said before, he never asked to be made public his trauma, but he knows I talk about it. He's a sadness or grief. He's a vulnerable emotion repressor, and that isn't what he is or who he is. It's just the shorthand that we use to describe somebody's primary repression, because repression is the root of suffering. So knowing someone's primary repression is just helpful. And he's known it for quite some time that vulnerable emotions are, they're incredibly difficult for him compared to something like anger. So you can imagine he's gotten angry as he's gone to see his grandmother, and that sadness wanted to come up. Sometimes he got angry, even at people trying to help him. He and I got into a spat where I was trying to help him because he was asking me about her life insurance. And I'm a former attorney, so I was answering the question. And I didn't give him an answer that he wanted. And he got angry at me. And basically, I just set a boundary with him. I knew he was going through a lot of pain, and I also know it doesn't give somebody an excuse to respond from a trauma response, an attack. But I also know that he's going through a lot of pain, and he cannot open to the pain, and he wants to because he knows it's healthy. He couldn't at that time. But frankly, the other good news is that was the only night that he was there visiting his grandmother where he wasn't opening to the sadness. And it was the only night that I saw him attacking people. Not attacking them, but being, you know, angry at people. And sometimes really angry. And I just noticed that night he wasn't in touch with his sadness. But almost every other night, because he went to visit her in Kansas, and we live in Nevada, so I'm here in Nevada. He's way over there in Kansas. And I know for a fact that he's cried every day because he called and talked to me each day and we cried together, or he cried at least every day with me. And me too with him quite often. So I know that he's opening to his sadness. And by the way, he's doing something he would never have done before. He's staying by her side so that she won't die alone. And that is so hard for him. Not only is he afraid to lose a person so that he's so important to him, but he's afraid to feel this emotion more than any emotion. The fear of grief, of losing someone, is terribly frightening to him. And yet he's there. It makes me want to cry, actually, right now. Just thinking about it. For anybody who's really facing their pain, and I don't mean, you know, just, I mean facing it. And that's what he's doing. That is not easy for any of us to face our primary repression. I think that's the part that makes me want to cry. It's not that his grandmother's dying. Of course that's sad, of course. That's been sad for quite some time. It will continue to be sad. But his, you know, he just called recently. And this is a family that did not express sadness with each other. Growing up, vulnerability is not something this family shared. If you could imagine four boys and a little girl as the kids, and then a mother and father, obviously, well, a mother and stepmother, and then their real mother really left, abandoned them, the kids, when they were very young. So there's very deep loss there, and that abandonment that was never processed with the biological mother. And then stepmother and father, just there was an emotional abandonment there for Chester. And well, for Chester, he didn't feel loved in the family. He was the kid who was really angry because he couldn't open to the sadness. He was considered a more difficult child, actually. Would have been considered that, and was, and doesn't really talk to his dad and his stepmom today. But he's right there with his whole family. His dad and his stepmother are not at the place where the grandmother is sick. They're not visiting. And that's another point you can imagine of contention and brings up anger. But I say all that to give you the context for what this family's going through, because these boys who are now there with Chester are all crying together. They never have even seen each other cry until, well, when they were kids, maybe if one got in trouble and then they started crying, but that's not the same kind of crying, vulnerable crying. It is, but it isn't. No, this is the first time he told me that he's ever, like his brother called him just to cry. And Chester said that was the most amazing thing he'd ever experienced in his life, and he just wants more of that. That's what makes me cry, because Chester's always been afraid of that emotion. And to know that he could connect in love with his brothers, who he couldn't connect with when he was kids, when they were kids. Because that, for one reason, because they couldn't open to the vulnerability. They're boys, you know? They're boys. This is what boys will be boys, as we say. It's tough. But they're not so tough when grandma's passing, of course. The real humanness comes out at some point, whether we like it or not. And Chester's leading the way as a kid who would never have opened up to sadness when he was a kid. He was always the angry one. Now he's opening up to sadness. And they are too. And they're doing it together. And that's really, really, really important. That families do that. Especially at the time of death, because grieving is so important. Grieving in a healthy way is so important for our health. If there's one thing I can tell you that I didn't bypass, it's sadness, grief, hurt, woundedness. I know how to meet those emotions. And I always have known how to since I got to spirituality, because they were safer for me on the surface. It's the anger and the fear of anger that I had buried. I lost six people close to me through the years, and dogs, and I mean close to me, like some best friends, very close friends. My best friend died, and our best friend, our other best friend died. So between the three of us, two of us are dead. We lived together for many years. A friend from AA and NA who I started a meeting with died. Good friend of mine. The first person I ever had sex with. And I had sex when I was between the ages of 6 and 10. A lot of sex with him. He died. The girl that I sang the senior song with, we were very good friends, went to the same college. She died. Grandmothers died. My mom died. Cousins, my aunt just died, actually, about 5 days ago. And then I died in 2007. Well, not really. I didn't completely die, but I had an awakening in 2007, and everything but my anger that I was afraid to feel and express seemed to, for the most part, die in a way. I don't miss him. I did grieve a little bit after that awakening for Scott, but I wasn't done with Scott. done living that, because I had to embody this realization. But I definitely know that I have a different view of death because of it. Not just because of being able to face grief and sadness, because that's how you deal with death. Part of it is the fear of opening to that emotion. But also death of self, too. There's a tremendous fear of recognizing that I'm not my story, right? Of quote-unquote waking up. There's an even bigger fear of embodying that realization. That's its own kind of death that people discover as they do this work. That's also where the deepest freedom is. In the embodiment. It's all relevant, even though the story of my partner and his brothers crying together, which is human and poignant, and to me actually more interesting than the non-dual thing, it's all so connected. For me, because I do know that I meet sadness and hurt and grief in a healthy way. And I don't know yet whether those brothers are. I know they're starting to open to the sadness. But when she dies in the next couple of days, it's going to be so big. They're in their mid to late 20s, these brothers. They're young. They don't know yet what death really is. They haven't felt it. They had a step-grandfather die, and of course it was devastating. But not like this will be. Not grandma. And you can't prepare for that. They can't. There's nothing they can do. But the reason it's connected to this work is, I think you all know, is that emotional repression is the root of suffering. So what these boys do during this death in some way influences, impacts the next few years and maybe the rest of their lives. How they deal with stuff like this. Especially as a family of sadness repressors. Well, they're not all sadness repressors, those boys, but vulnerability is not, you don't win popularity contests in that family. You didn't growing up. I wasn't there, but from what I hear. Stay tuned. I want to connect it more because I just know that there are people who listen to me who are at any given time, we don't even have a huge audience here, but at any given time, somebody's dealing with something that is really big. Maybe somebody's listening right now. It so makes this job, what I do here, worth it, if you want to call it a job, is knowing that if I can reach somebody, just if you're sitting in your living room, God, that makes me want to cry. You're just sitting in your living room and you're going through something, just to know that we're all the same, dealing with the same emotions, and we're all the same awareness. And even though nobody knows your pain because it's your pain, by sharing about this, somehow, I don't know, it makes it okay for you to open to that. Better yet, I have some skills for you. No, that's a whole nother thing. Don't assume we're just opening to emotions just because we're having them. Because we hold a lot back. Stay tuned. I'm going to talk about what happens when we don't hold it back. Well, I don't know about you. But I built a life from and around not feeling emotion. I mean, I built a life around it. My whole life was built around the repression of anger. All of my suffering, for the most part, came from shame and the repression of anger and a few other things. And the shame was deeply tied to the anger. So if you have shame, it's tied to your primary repression. But I think this whole thing for me has been about, when I look back at the whole awakening and process that I've gone through, it looked like it was about awakening, but it's really about emotion, is what I'm here to say for myself. It looked like it was about, I was going to wake up to what I really am, be free of all this suffering. And the truth is, it's about waking up to be what I really am and to be free of all this suffering. However, in order for that to happen, I have to feel fucking everything. That's what I learned. And so do you. And there's no way around it. And I mean everything. And whatever you refuse to feel will be your remaining suffering, pretty much. I'm sorry to report that. You don't have to agree. But I definitely have to report it because it's my experience. And they call me a teacher. I even call myself that sometimes. And I can stand by that. I'll stand by that so much, I'll say you have to go further than that. There are buried emotions that you're already programmed not to feel. Those need to be dealt with because those are the root of suffering. They don't need to. Unless you want to suffer, though, is what I've learned. You have to get to the root. But what does that mean? It means feel everything. See, what happens to these boys when she dies is everything. Because quite a few of them are already sadness and grief repressors. What Chester said to me on the phone was, my family is so grateful to you, Scott, because if it weren't for you, we wouldn't be able to cry together right now, and we wouldn't be able to do this for each other at the time of her death. And you know, people say that to me a lot, actually. You might wonder, oh, does that make me feel good? Of course that's a good thing. But I'll tell you how I respond to things like that. When people say that your work or what you've done has been a positive influence, I don't get the same kind of dopamine hit that I used to get. I don't get that. And so it kind of, when it comes up, I'm not distracted by that, which helps. Because a lot of people look at that hit and they'll just want to keep helping people. And I don't get that, but it is still nice. I'm not going to say it's not nice. That's kind of mean, actually, to say. Because, no, I appreciate it, for sure. Appreciate it. But I just see it within a larger context, you know? It's so great that these boys at age 26, 27, and 28 can finally start to open to that emotion. But I also know that in their daily life, they're not going to go back and open to hurt or emotion or anger in their relationships, because none of them, except Chester, process. Like right now, they're forced to feel something because she's passing. But we've trained ourselves not to in everyday life. So even though it's great news to hear that they're opening to this emotion and pulling them together, and they're dealing with her passing probably healthier than they would have, for sure, because there's all addiction there too, as you can imagine, when there's repression. We still have a road ahead of us, don't we? All of us. In terms of our relationship to emotions, every single day of our lives. And when I think about the addiction and mental health and other physical issues that are plaguing that family right now, I think of how relevant this conversation is. You know, and maybe this conversation, even though those boys will never hear this, Chester might hear this podcast. His brothers probably won't, though. Yet, in a way, what I have to say to them, or what, if there's an influence that this work has in their lives, it hasn't even touched them yet. I'm so glad that they can open to the sadness and the fear of that right now more. But the suffering is in their lives, just like the suffering is in your lives. It's there when they go back, when she passes. Assuming that they deal with that in a way that is healthy, because when someone actually passes, the waves of grief can be so big that how everyone deals with that is different. But assuming that they get through with that in a healthy way, because if they don't, that's going to affect their future. They just don't know it. I treated people at my mental health addiction treatment centers quite often. It was because of unprocessed grief from something in childhood. Somebody died or something happened. And because it was never processed, they spent a life in addiction or mental health issues. And it wasn't the only issue, you know, that they were facing. But it's certainly a big one for certain people. And each of these boys will be deeply and profoundly affected. See, they're probably going to do better because they're opening to it. Just generally because of the death, they'll probably do better. It's like, what are the possible alternatives here? Imagine that if they weren't even able to see, there are family members right now who are not opening up to it. You know how it is. There are people who are not visiting. There are people who are going to feel guilt upon the passing, upon her passing, because we're only human. And they're going to have to feel that. But these boys, at least, because they're opening to their sadness and their fear of sadness hasn't overcome them so much that they won't connect with each other and with her at the end of her life, they're going to do that much better. They may not know it, but they're going to do that much better in the weeks and months and years to come in their families and their daily lives just because of that. And the family members who can't make it and who have to feel that extra layer of guilt will do just that much worse in the weeks and months to come, whether they know it or not, because emotional repression and suppression is the root of a lot of suffering. So those mental health and addiction issues, even of the family members who are, especially of the family members who cannot connect with their own emotions right now, will be affected by this. I have a bit of a cold right now. And I've just seen that in my own work. I just know it. You know, do I know it like a fact, like something before me right now? Math? I don't know it like that. But I think you know it too, don't you? But these are the things we don't face. We really, really don't face it until we do. Not just death, but emotions. Really, it's about emotions. You know, let me tell you, I'm going to go to the next segment. Let me tell you how I grew up and why my relationship to grief and sadness is healthy compared to anger. And why I think it helps me. I've shared about this before, but this is about death, so I'm going to talk about it again. How it has helped me in my life. But just because I had a healthy relationship with an emotion, eventually I didn't mean that I didn't suffer. So a relationship with one emotion essentially is all that we need in order to suffer. But most of us repress and suppress more than one. And some of us feel like we can't ex feel and express any of them. And I was pointing that out because all of this has an impact in our lives. That's why this work is so important, I think, because it has such an impact. Whether we open to emotions, stay tuned. Well, I titled the last segment that emotions have the biggest impact in our lives, but it's our relationship to emotions, really. And also, it's not all negative impact. If we open to our emotions, there's a deep and positive impact in our lives. And when we can't open to them, there is a negative and detrimental impact. And kind of, it's not that simple in terms of suffering, but it is kind of. Because, well, there's environment, there are genetic things. But even genetics are influenced by intergenerational trauma. And environment, in other words. So here we are. We can't escape the emotion conversation. I tried to escape it as a teacher. I included emotions, but not anger. So look at us teachers. There'll be certain emotions. Look for the missing experience in your lives. What is the emotion that you're most afraid of, that you see and feel and express the less, the least? What is the emotion that your teachers and your practices and your institutions feel and express the least? Have you bonded with institutions and teachers and people who don't feel and express the emotion that you are most afraid of? See, because I built a life by the time I was 40-something. I built a life, before I met Chester, of relationships in which I didn't really have to feel anger. I did still, but because it would come through. You know, all you have to do is like marry somebody or date somebody, even as a anger repressor, and you're going to find anger eventually. You know, you'll still try to keep it down probably. But like what I did in my first marriage is I would hold things back, you know, and use presents and that and keep the anger buried and just process triggers on top of the contraction. And that's what almost everybody does until they learn how to go into the self-contraction. But, you know, the self-contraction, the repression produces triggers. So after the awakening, it was mostly no triggers. But when a trigger would come up, of course I would continue to store anger. But I would open to woundedness and hurt and sadness, which felt safer. So that, over time, then becomes a bypass in a spiritual process. I just wanted you to see how that happens, because you might be doing the same thing, but with a different emotion that's missing. It could be sadness, or grief, hurt. The reason I know that it's missing for us is not just because I've reversed my own emotional repression. It's my own life. And your life will show it to you too in different ways. Like Chester's life taught him that sadness is not safe. His family taught him that. But my life, my family taught me that sadness is okay. Dad used to sit next to me and cry about different things. Not a lot, but from time to time he would. And he just showed me vulnerability. But he was also masculine, so I had this view that if you share sadness or vulnerability, that does not diminish your any masculinity. In fact, it makes you look stronger. That's how I grew up. I had other issues with my dad, a lot of anger, because he wanted me to be something that I couldn't. I was a little gay kid, and he wanted me to be something else. But sadness and grief, he modeled that well, actually. Mom, not so much on that. But neither one of them modeled anger well. So that's just the question is, what was it like in your family? Because, again, once you know the missing experience, you know what the repression is. It's missing. It's tricky. I think what I'm really saying here tonight is, yeah, I want to focus on you. Because on this topic of death, I think I'm going to be okay, at least with the people in my life that die. I haven't died yet, physical death, so I can't tell you what that's going to be like. But I've already lost a lot. And I know I'm going to lose more people on the level of form. But I also know how to grieve and feel. It's not fun, but I know how. It's just like Eckhart said when his mom died, waves of grief. But if they're allowed, they're allowed. I just want to know what your relationship is with sadness and vulnerability. And then I want you to look around at the people in your life that you love. And just know, this is not to upset you. Especially if you've been angry at those people for a while. You may have reason to be angry at them. But when people pass, it is different, as you know. And all the feelings that we didn't really feel in some way they become relevant when somebody passes, more than ever in a way, because we either just tuck them away seemingly forever or we process them. And it's at somebody's death or the loss of something, even a relationship, actually a breakup, that we really see how we feel. And sometimes it's a little bit too late, or it is too late. Either in a breakup or a split in the family or a death. Because if it's death or if it's a final thing, all we can do is process. if that, when somebody's gone. But just remember, there may still be, see, we've built a life around trauma. So you might be looking at, I don't know who you're looking at or how many people you're looking at in your life right now that you really love. Let's talk about that in the next segment, because that, those people, what I've learned, those people are more important to your well-being than I am. And I mean that. Or anybody who purports to be a teacher or a therapist or a doctor. Those people and your relationship to your emotions with those people, that's the key to your health, to your happiness, to your well-being, to your awakeness. This I know. Stay tuned. So yeah, death isn't real, but it hurts like hell. But look around at the people that I just want to keep it to my experience. Because even though I've had a good relationship with sadness and grief, I haven't had a good relationship with anger or the fear of anger. And that's connected to sadness and grief. They're all connected because it's all relationship. And there's no separation between anything or anyone ultimately. So the anger that I couldn't open to with my mother while she was still alive, and the avoidance that I did of her, avoiding her, I didn't know why. It's anger repression. That's the root of suffering, if that's your repression. That happened to me, mine. I was avoiding her and her grief and sadness that she was experiencing in life. She was really down and depressed, but also angry and not opening to those emotions and struggling a lot. And in my own words, she would be difficult to be around. In my words, that was my perception. And so, you know, I was a busy teacher. This is what I would have told myself. And frankly, when you wake up to your true nature, you don't have the kind of attachment to your parents that you used to have. And that is true of all those teachers that say that is true. At the same time, what's also true is what Eckhart says, is when you lose a parent, if you have a healthy relationship with sadness, you're going to grieve. And both of those things are true. I've seen it in experience. Because as we're living, we get clearer, we don't have the same attachment to mom and dad and to getting their love and approval. And that's why we can be free and how we can be free in this lifetime. And most of us want that. I mean, I don't know if you've seen how much of our suffering comes from mom and dad programs in the body. Unbelievable amount. Unless we had different caretakers as a kid, or we had a parent who died or something. But, or, you know, for mine, a lot of my trauma was at school. And at home. But parents are a big part of all this. And it's true that when you wake up, as you guys know, for those of you who've had a shift to presence, depending on how deep that's gone in your body, because there's an embodiment process, you get to a place where you move in the world differently than you used to. You're just not moving to get their love and approval, nor are you projecting it on other people, trying to get other people's love and approval. And that's what healing has really been like for me, is to be myself authentically, to embody this presence, and to not live my life for other people, which is what I did and I suffered, to live for their feelings and all that. and to hide and bury my own, in other words. But I hide and buried my own still while my mother was alive, even in the awakeness, as I say, with the buried anger and showing up as chronic pain. While she was alive, what was so poignant is before I became a teacher, I got clean off drugs and alcohol and was clean for 8 years, I think, eight, before she died. But she was using a lot. And that's also another reason that I justified disconnecting from her, which a lot of us addicts do because, you know, we learn to stay away from friends, family, and others, even if there's been a sort of a dysfunctional codependent relationship in some way that might continue on. But I was using that as an excuse because by the time the shift of presence happened, I had the capacity to hold these emotions. I just wasn't processing those, or I didn't know how yet. And sometimes these things that we use from spirituality and 12 step, even though they're true, that, you know, especially in early recovery, some of us just can't for a while go around certain people and things, especially if we don't have inquiry, and I didn't. And so, you know, you protect yourself in early recovery. That is not the same as 8 years later, though, when the reason I was not really connecting with mother is, one, the shift of presence happened, so I wasn't needing her approval, at least as far as I could see. But with the anger repression, there's always some of that there buried in the body with the rage. But that was buried. But for the most part, in the visible realm of my consciousness, there was no sense that I needed to go connect with mom. I didn't think she was going to die that early. I was still unconscious, though. Because although it's true the awakening frees us from those unhealthy attachments that we just don't ever let go of if we don't do this kind of work, and we need that to heal, I really firm conviction around that. We have to be careful, don't we, with spirituality and awakening and even recovery, in different ways we use it. I did. To justify in some ways how I was responding to my mother while she was alive. That's why I said take a look around at the people, even if you're not getting along with them, the people that you know that you love. And here's the weird thing I have to tell you is, I don't know how to express it, but the way that you have related to those people will and is probably changing now. If you're being more your authentic self by doing this work and getting to the repression, I don't know where you're at in that work, though. Like, if you're at the very beginning and you're looking around at people that trigger you, or even that you're disconnected from people as you start this work, you don't have a lot of people around you. Anger repressors can have that. So can sadness repressors. It's safer for us. But just look around. Because even though this work brings you to this recognition of what you really are, and you embody that, and you don't need what you thought you needed from those people. So you're probably seeing that. And if you're going deep, you're probably seeing that there are certain people that you truly love, even if you've had difficulty with them. Are you tracking me? There may be people that you're looking around and you're saying, I love them, but I can't. I can't be around them, or I can't do this or that with them. And that's okay too. I just want you to notice because it's all relevant in terms of the people that you love. There are some people that we've had to cut out of our lives. I understand that. For whatever reason. What our relationship with is and with them is also relevant to some degree because repression is held in the body. So just because we're not looking at some people that were once there doesn't mean that they're not relevant. I'm not going into that right now. Because we hold this stuff in our bodies and we tend not to see all this. I want to talk about the people that you still have some. They're in your life still in some way. And they probably will be. The people that probably will be. You don't know that. We don't know anything. But chances are these are the people that would be there for the rest of your life or their lives or whatever. Just pull them up for a second. If they stick around, you can bet that you'll have guilt when they die. If at the time, well, between now and then, you love them, but you can't be yourself. I'll just say it that way. It looks like while we're living that from the unconsciousness that staying safe and getting their love is and their approval is the most important thing. It looks like that. Maybe. But that's how I think we suffer upon their passing. Let me say it that way. Because if we come from that while they're living, then we're not being ourselves. We know that from this work. We're identifying with false stuff. We're being people pleasers, for example. We're not speaking up. We're not sharing our authentic feelings, right? Ego is there with these people. Staying safe, getting love. All of that coming from emotional repression. So it might seem like, you know, you might be doing patterns with these people, keep repeating patterns in that way, suffering patterns. And this is how you love these people. You know what I mean? And the prospect of actually being yourself in this lifetime with them might be terrifying, even. Because it might feel like you would lose them. Or something like that, right? But what if you lose them without being yourself with them in this lifetime? Have you ever really considered that? Because that's what I had to deal with my mother. And I do think that my mother's passing somehow started this or contributed to the starting of this repression work. Because it took me a while to see that I just hadn't dealt with my anger by the time that she died. And I was, yeah. And so how I related to her while she was alive was affected by that anger repression, is what I want to say. When she died, these feelings that it never felt safe to feel came forth. The guilt on my side, the anger eventually. Certainly the grief and sadness, they came up first when she died because that was safer for me, the anger repressor. But everything has to be dealt with in some way, I'm saying, when people die. Whether we just continue bearing something, like continuing bearing my anger for mom even when she passed. Yes, I did. Because I didn't know how to access that. So that obviously had an effect on me because that buried anger then became chronic pain. It wasn't just the anger for mom that led to that. It was anger. But mom was in that. And when she was alive, I was doing things with her that were not authentic for me, but I didn't know it. And those things contributed to my suffering after her death. And the suffering, obviously, while she was alive, between me and her. It wasn't a tremendous amount. We had conversations every now and then. And they were not unpleasant conversations, frankly. But I was not being myself. I had not been able to be myself fully with my parents my whole life because of anger repression. I grew up as a people pleaser. That's not what I am. But a lot of it, I was people-pleasing with mom. I wouldn't say like how I really felt. I didn't know. So I couldn't show up with her. So when she died, there was this guilt that I didn't know where it came from. You know, like the first layer of the guilt is like, well, I could have done something to keep her from dying or something. Maybe I didn't realize she was sick, or I didn't. Well, so some of those thoughts came up. Yeah. But no, this is like a deeper guilt around. It's just not that simple, you know? You can't point to it like that. Stay tuned. Hopefully it's resonating and you can look in your own life and see where I'm going here, but not done yet. My dad is still alive, real quick, and he has a girlfriend and he's very much into that relationship. We don't hear much from dad. Once mom died, he did get into another relationship, but my relationship with dad is much more authentic when we're talking. Unlike with me and mom, we can both get angry and do at things and also can love each other and feel the hurt and sadness throughout things that are happening in the family and talk about it. So it's just more authentic, and I'm not holding. I've done my work around anger towards dad, so things have shifted. Plus, there's just the presence, so I don't really need his love and approval, too. That's also true. So it's healthier, but I'll also grieve, I'm sure, when he dies. But with mom, it was different because, like I was saying in the last segment, it's what we don't feel before they pass. That, I don't know, we may not even see it when they pass, though, because this stuff is really unconscious. Through the years, I've learned that if I'm working with somebody who has lost somebody and didn't get to grieve in a healthy way and they're suffering because of it, then I almost never go to the grief first. If anything, when we finally get to the grief, if it's just kind of pure grief, like I love that person and they're gone, I don't know if there's a ton of processing to do at that point. Unless the person is a sadness repressor and just cannot open to this, the pure sadness of losing somebody, which is very natural sadness, of course. So is the fear of it, though. The fear of sadness is natural. If you grew up in a family like Chester's, it's natural for that family, for him. But sadness is certainly natural for us when people pass. If we can feel it, certain sadness repressors might not be able to, though. I mean, when we get to the grief, they just needed inquiry. They couldn't just feel the sadness now that the other layers of grief, of guilt and anger were peeled away, or shame or whatever else is there. But that's where I would go with them, is to these other layers, which had not really to do with the sadness of the person's passing, not really to do with death, but what didn't get felt and expressed while the person was alive. Because emotional repression and suppression is the driver of suffering. So the person has died, but the reason that this person in front of me is really suffering is bigger than the death and the sadness around the death. See, it's the same thing I had with my mom. And others, like I had a best friend that died, and I had fallen in love with him years ago, and he had some feelings back. We had sort of a relationship, even sexual, but he couldn't open to that, and we split apart. And I had some real feelings for him, obviously, that didn't get processed because my anger repression didn't get processed. And he died also during the time I was a teacher. And I went into that too during this healing process. But it's okay, so it's the stuff that we don't feel while people are living. Look around at the people that I was pointing to in your life. And I'm telling you that it just keeps coming back to emotional repression no matter what topic I talk about. And I know that annoys people, some people, because I've seen comments. But, you know, remember, science tells us that this is the root of a lot of our suffering. Not all of it, but a lot of it. And here's an example, or examples of how we relate to people while they're living is really more of a determining factor about our suffering after they die. And, okay, so I have to tell you the good news about being able to grieve in a healthy way if you can't. As many issues as that were there with Mom, with my not being able to express anger, she had her own repression and trauma unprocessed and other addiction issues and stuff. But being able to process that and eventually the anger with this work, now when I see my mom in my memory, she's gone, it's always the same memory. And I was never alive for this memory. This seems to be a memory before I was. No, I was alive, but I was too young. She's in the swing. I don't know where the swing is. She's smiling. She's swinging. She's kind of looking at me or us. And she's fine. And I'm fine. And everyone's fine. And that's just love there for her. But there's been a lot of different emotions there with her, right? As you can imagine, processing. And it's because all those other emotions have been allowed, including the anger and the shame and all that, that I can just feel that love and not suffer because of her passing. So when I think about you guys with people that you love who may die someday, you can't prepare for that, nor would you want to, because that would just be like not wanting to feel something, right? Be like, so I can do some inquiry to make sure I don't feel sad when somebody dies. Good luck with that. I think sadness is just natural. As Eckhart says, I always point to him because people see him as fully embodied, maybe. But then he had those waves of sadness. I don't think we want to use inquiry that way, right? That's why I sometimes, when people get to that, when they finally just feel sad because somebody died, we don't necessarily process that with inquiry unless they suppress or repress it. Because it's just natural to be sad. Somebody died that you love. Let it come through. Unless you have conditioning that won't let it. And some people don't know that, though. That's another reason to do this work, because if you are feeling sadness because of somebody dying or a breakup or something, are you really feeling it? Is there contraction in your body with it? You know what I mean? Like a denser contraction with it? That indicates repression of something. Even if you can open to sadness, remember that. The contraction in your body is something. Could be anger repression, actually, or sadness repression. You have to test for this stuff is what I mean, because your system only produces what's safer than whatever you buried. So you're with these folks, they're still alive. Your system is not producing, obviously, the buried stuff, but it's the buried stuff that's producing the suffering that you're seeing in your life with these people, the triggers and such. Or when you can't be authentic. See? And then when they pass, those emotions that you're carrying in your body now become like the source of suffering around their death, because the sadness itself will be quite natural. I mean, you know what I mean by that. But these other emotions you may have difficulty with, like unprocessed anger, as I did with Mom, I held it in the body. Or shame from a childhood of Mom never giving me the space to be myself, it felt like. And I always felt shamed by Mom and Dad, not processing it. That was joined in there with the sadness, see? But that didn't really have anything to do with her death. That had to do with her life and my life. This has to do with life. That's why I say, look around. You can't prepare, nor should you really use inquiry to try to prepare to not be sad when somebody dies. I don't think that's good. But can you be sad while somebody's alive? Can you be angry? Can you feel these things? Do you allow yourself to feel and express these things? You can't if you have repression or suppression. I mean, we can sit here from the conscious level and say, hey, are you allowing your feelings? I'm allowing mine. We're allowing the safer ones. If we're allowing any at all, it would be the ones that are safer and not buried. So we have to go deeper even while they're alive. We don't have to, but think about this. If it's the buried stuff that's creating the suffering that we're experiencing, the safer stuff, and when they die, it'll be the buried stuff that will contribute to the suffering then, that will produce it then, both in life and death. It's the buried stuff that we want to get to in life. But it's really not for them, you know. It is, though. Let me explain that before I go. Like, we do this work for ourselves, right? Because we're suffering. And maybe that's why we sometimes don't want to do this work, because, you know, we're afraid that we'll cry or tell dad we're hurt or get angry at mom or something or somebody that might die at some point. We might lose them if we do that. So we continue to suffer, right? In those relationships, afraid to do this work or resistant to it. You know how it is. But we do it for ourselves, and you know that. And even though there's resistance, you'll probably keep doing it because you want to be free. But I want you to think of it, because there's an element here where people think they're being selfish if they do this work and get free in this lifetime. Or not necessarily selfish, but like they have to continue suffering. Like that's a requirement of life, that you have to show up with these people in the way that you've always shown up, as a people pleaser, or like Chester, not crying, tougher than he really feels he is. But the truth of it is, authenticity is good for them too. It's good for everybody, actually. Because when we don't have it in our lives, we have suffering, and in our relationships. So it's essentially moving. It's moving to reduce or eliminate suffering in these relationships while they're alive, while we are alive. Let's not forget where the suffering comes from. It's the buried stuff, the stuff that we don't or can't or are too afraid to feel. We can't forget that that's where it comes from. And when they're suffering on their side too. Our unconsciousness contributes to the suffering on both sides. It's hard to see that when you're in repression, because we think that being this way is how I have to be to get love, stay safe. But they're suffering too, see? Many of them. You're suffering, they're suffering. And nobody is transforming. Right? Usually the people that are doing this work are the first people in a relationship to really start to transform, right? You're the one that's going to do it. It's not going to be those people. See that? And yet everybody's suffering. It's kind of up to you. You can't save them. It's not about that. But isn't it up to you? Because if anybody's going to introduce something different, something other than suffering in these relationships, it looks like it might be you. This fear of losing people, I want to talk about it before we go. This fear of losing people in life by being ourselves. the way that this healing happens, this repression work is really works in our life, is it doesn't happen all at once. You know how we seek awakening, we want to just wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, and now I'm awake and done. The true embodiment process doesn't work like that. It's a process, and you want it to be. And here's why. You want to feel what it's like to reverse just a little bit of repression, just to transmute some, and then go be with these people. And see what it's like to continue to be fake or not be authentic or suffer, as opposed to also seeing some changes, even if they're small changes at first. Because we're dealing with trauma. Do you want all those changes at once, really? Do you want to just go in there and then unload all your hurt and anger from the past? Isn't that what you're afraid of happening? So here we don't want the wham, bam, thank you, ma'am experience. I think we want to be mature about what we're really doing so that we can actually transform. So what we do is we make the present moment awareness our home from the beginning here. Practices and such for that. But we just, each day we pick up a practice, this practice, and start to go into the root of suffering. And we just experience the change. It's not really like training our consciousness to be a little bit more authentic. See how that works. Is that safe enough? Is that okay? You know? And just experience that suffering go away a little bit. And then we continue processing those layers. And now we come back. You see? Same people. We might be setting a little bit more, or setting more boundaries, or speaking up a little bit more, or being a little bit more vulnerable though as we go. And then we continue to have the practice in our life. And over time, in the process, even though we're making awareness primary, we actually notice the changes unfolding. Forget time as in a story. We're actually experiencing it in our lives as an unfolding in the moment. It's always now. So we're seeing that how we relate to these people is changing in a way that we can deal with. See, it's not scary. As scary as it might be if we contemplate, I'm just going to go open all this up and be free, and then now I'm going to be totally different, you know? And yeah, scaring the shit out of ourselves. There's no way that I would have picked up some method that would have reversed all of the anger that I had for mom in one day or a week, and I just call mom up and unload all that rage on her. I wasn't ready for that. No process can really do that in a week's time or whatever. But had I had this process back then, I think what I would have done is just like I say to people, you know, mom's going to call in the next few days, do some inquiry on your anger that you carry still with mom or the people around you right now, or the buried sadness or hurt. So that when she calls, you feel what it's like to be a little bit different with her, a little bit more natural, but like just a little bit, right? Because it's mom, it's dad, and I get it. But you still have the process, and the phone call ends or the conversation's over, and you have process. You go a little bit deeper with it. Next phone call, next meeting is different. You're easing into this, not unloading everything at once, not necessarily saying something every time you are with them. It's an energetic change in how you're being with them. And if you stay with it, they're changing too with you. See? And if they absolutely can't, you may have to set some boundaries or suffer. What I mean by them changing with us is if you start responding differently, the patterns in our parents and the people around us, they can't continue exactly the same way without a lot of suffering. So they start, there's like this space for people. For some people are very resistant to just start also opening up more. See that? And feeling and expressing a little bit more. That's what I mean. It's a process. Such that when my mom died then, I would have energetically been different with her as it unfolded. I don't know what that would have looked like. But then the guilt that I felt when she died, because the guilt was about not saying and being who I really was with her. And that was the anger repression. And the shame. Don't forget those people around you are your teachers. Thank you. If you're interested in getting started on this path, go to killoby.com, K-I-L-O-B-Y.com. Scroll to the bottom of the page. I'll take you through a test which will show you, one, if you have emotional repression, and if you're suffering, you do. Two, what emotions you buried. And three, how that emotional repression produces suffering in your life. Killoby.com, scroll to the bottom of the page.